This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Network. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Network does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm your host, Jason Breifel. Today is a really exciting show. I'm joined by three historians here in the studio, and we're going to be recognizing President's Day, which was just this last weekend. And I'm really pleased to be joined by Dr. Gautam Rao, Associate Professor of History at American University, Dr. Dana Stefanelli, Assistant Editor of the Papers of George Washington at the Washington Library in Mount Vernon, a.k.a. the Washington Presidential Library, and Zach Klitzman, the Senior Executive Assistant at President Lincoln's Cottage here in Washington, D.C. Thank you all for joining us here in the studio this morning. Before we dive in, I want to remind our listeners that Fed Talk is brought to you by Long-Term Care Partners. Long-Term Care Partners administers the Office of Personnel Management-sponsored Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program. Gautam, Zach, Dana, welcome, and happy to have you here on Fed Talk this morning.
Morning.
Thank you.
Well, let's just dive in here. You guys have a really interesting array of experience and perspective studying. What we'll be looking at today is the period of the Founding Fathers, diving in specifically into George Washington and bridging out to President Lincoln. So looking at that kind of the founding period in the first 100 years or so in the nation's official history. And so I'd like to just kind of dive in here, and we can maybe go down the line. And how did the role of the founders, several of whom became presidents themselves, kind of shape our history and the role of the presidency itself? Maybe we'll start with you, Gautam.
Sure. Good morning. I think one of the more compelling aspects of the story here is just how much work had to be done to build the presidency. Things were in such disarray during the Revolution, during the war, and in the aftermath of the war. The Articles of Confederation, which precede the Constitution, are notorious for a lack of central power. So things are just kind of out of whack from a governmental perspective. And so one reason why we see the presidency as an institution become so important in these founding era struggles is because of the need to have an executive power that is going to be responsible for things like finance and military affairs. So to me, that's probably the most compelling aspect of the story.
I think that's exactly right. It perhaps wasn't clear that an executive would be necessary, right? During the Revolution, the Continental Congress moved toward having people or small committees that carried out executive functions. When the Confederation, Articles of Confederation were approved, and as the Confederation government operated, those became more formalized. You had a secretary for war, and so parts of Congress with executive functions. But it was really that experience of the Revolution and the Confederation years, like Gautam alluded to, that made it clear that a stronger, more formal executive power was needed. And so when it came to the Constitutional Convention, and of course we can get into some big theoretical questions about divided government and separate branches, but it was clear to everyone that some sort of permanent executive power was required for the government to function properly. Exactly what that power would be was not really all that well defined until the end of the Constitutional Convention, and much of it, as we know now, was sort of left up to the precedents and experiences and decisions of the first president to define the role or to flesh out exactly what a president would be, what the executive branch would be going forward. So, you know, that is one of Washington's great contributions that most historians recognize, is that role that he played in putting the flesh on the bones of those early years in the constitutional process.
I think it's worthwhile mentioning also that while this was an apparent need for this power, that there's also great anxiety about it, right? Because of the revolutionary experience, and Americans were not so fond of the king towards the end of the British period. So that's the constraint that's going to be so evident at the Constitutional Convention, and even well after this notorious American distrust of centralized authority within a single person, or even the federal government. We could talk about it that way. So that has its roots as part of the same story.
Yeah, what was probably invaluable there is you know, I sound like a broken record, but I guess we are talking about Washington and his presidency. Was the man in question who had given up power once at the end of the Revolution, and so that precedent was really made an impression on people's minds that probably this was someone who could be trusted with this power that there was so much anxiety about to hand someone executive power, knowing that that person would not be tempted to keep it because he had proven once that he would give it up. So, in that sense, that action, having fought the revolution, won it, become, you know, perhaps the most famous person in the world at that time, and then given that power up was something remarkable to the minds of people in that era when there were few democracies, few people willing to give up the power that they had acquired. This guy, George Washington, did that. And so if you're going to have someone with this executive power, and all the negative consequences that can come from it, then this is probably the guy you want to have.
And even jumping ahead a little bit, you could almost say he gave it up again when he left after his second term. You know, the Constitution certainly didn't prescribe two-term limits back then. And it really was a huge precedent that lasted until Roosevelt to really give up after two terms, or not give up, but relinquish the presidency and the power that came with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I think, giving it up twice, I think it was even King George III thought this was so remarkable that he called George Washington the greatest man of this age. So, it gives you a sense of sort of a level of disbelief that people had that this actually happened, that somebody was willing to do that twice.
He's also very wary of fusing his military background into the presidency, although he is commander in chief. This fear of putting the military power within the executive seat, I think, is another precedent we could list alongside the term limit.
Well, you know, I think what's most interesting about this conversation is, Congress did grapple with many of these things. American history is all about the tension between power and authority, who should have it, where should it reside, how do you break it up to provide balance to protect citizens against tyranny, ultimately. But what I'm hearing from you all is that a lot of this really was based on, the guy who cast the mold, our first president. And so not as much as policy or laws, it's kind of the norms of the office, kind of built in additional kind of maybe they're more cultural guide rails. And I think that's a really interesting dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, even discussions that, and jump in here, but how he was referred to, kind of the dress of the Congress, both the physical dress and also just how you kind of, defer to someone like Washington. Do you bow? those kind of debates over kind of the cultural, you know, atmosphere of the president. How does he get treated? Is he, you know, a peer among equals, or is he more elevated in that sense, in the balance of powers?
Yeah, his own dress, right? Yeah. The way people dress to receive him and the way he dressed to receive people, things like that. Those were important considerations in a monarchy, and so they would probably be important considerations in a new republic.
It was a very fine line to walk because on the one hand, he couldn't replicate exactly the regal atmosphere of a king. But on the other hand, this new federal government, nobody quite knew what it was, but it needed some sort of legitimacy. So it had to have some level of respect attached to it. And so his ability to entertain guests in the home and conduct affairs of state in a way that was viewed by pretty much everyone as above board, as beyond reproach, I think was really, really important to the cultural politics of the institution.
Great. You know, I want to pick up on this thread and talk a little bit more about Washington, but also something you mentioned, Dana, kind of we needed a place for the federal city and kind of placing some of this power, and maybe that's part of the bounds of creating legitimacy around the government, and as we are now here broadcasting from Washington, D.C., I think it'll be interesting for our listeners to take a little trip down how we got here and why this city exists as it does. We're going to take our first break. We're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Network, 1500 AM.
Make long-term care insurance part of your retirement plan. Long-term care is expensive, and it's not covered by traditional types of insurance plans. With benefits designed specifically for the federal family, the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program offers a smart way to help protect savings and assets and remain independent should you need long-term care services someday. Start planning for the future. Take the next step and visit LTCFEDS.com today. That's LTCFEDS.com.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Network, 1500 AM. Joined here today by three historians discussing the early presidents and in our President's Day theme show. I want to pick back up where we had left off, talking about the role of George Washington specifically and forming the norms around the presidency, and also bringing kind of legitimacy to this new office and to the new federal government that was formed following the end of the Revolutionary War. Dana, do you want to kick us off?
I think a lot of the issues that confronted George Washington at the beginning of the presidency were the issues that had lingered for years that the Confederation government could not solve or could not resolve, could not debate and pass legislation on to everyone's satisfaction. And then so for Washington in his first term and the first Congress and those first 2 years of his first term, a lot of what they did, Congress did, and what he did was to debate and resolve some of those questions that remained outstanding. So the Constitution had set up a framework for this debate and for resolving things. I mean, that was part of the sense of things was that the Articles of Confederation didn't really have the mechanisms necessary to actually implement policy. And so now you have a government, presumably, that does, right? The government under the new Constitution. But you actually have to go and do those things that the Confederation government was not doing. So you've got some big questions out there, right? There's the money question, the financial issues that Gautham alluded to early on. There's questions about representation. There's a federal judiciary to essentially create from scratch. There's the debts outstanding from the Revolution and how to finance those debts, so the public finance question. There's the seat of government question, where will Congress meet? We call it a capital nowadays, but they pretty much exclusively referred to it as the seat of government back then. So those were all major issues that that were left outstanding when Washington took office. And so, you know, his task, Congress's task, was to find a way forward after years of fits and starts and stops and things like that.
On the seat of government question, I think that was particularly poignant in the 1780s because of the jealousies that had really marred the period under the Articles of Confederation, where states, even cities, were incredibly jealous of each other. This is, again, an enduring American tradition. You can ask New Yorkers what they think of Boston, or Philadelphians what they think of the rest of the country. Resolving this problem meant that if there was going to be a federal government that was independent, its own sovereign entity, that it had to be in a sovereign place, essentially, that was not going to be controlled by one of the big urban centers and states. So the capital makes its appearance briefly in New York and Philly, and those are, of course, controlled by – those are two of the largest states, two of the most powerful as well. So that was not going to suit as a long-term problem. It's in the Constitution that this national – federal city would have to exist in its own place, and so Washington is the driving force in placing it where it ends up.
Yeah, and one interesting kind of precedent for creating this independent city is, I believe, 1783, there was a mutiny of soldiers who surrounded Congress in Philadelphia, or not necessarily a mutiny, it's called the Philadelphia Mutiny, but these veterans demanding pay for their service in the war. And Congress wasn't really doing anything with it, and they called upon the governor of Pennsylvania to put down the, you know, the protesters, and he said nothing doing. And so this kind of set the precedent in their mind, the framers, that we need a jurisdiction that is under control of Congress so that we can say, you know, call up the militia to put down any such insurrection or something like that. That's why, as Gotham said, in Article 1, Section 8, there's this clause about the exclusive jurisdiction of Congress will control the city. And, of course, everyone here in D.C. knows that's led to, you know, several hundred years of discussions over home rule in the district.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, the federal city or the seat of government issue goes back even before, you know, the Revolution or dates from the Revolution, in the sense that, you know, related to the monarchy question, you had, you know, in London, you had this place from which the American colonies were ruled and from which Americans received a lot of great benefits. You know, it was London that was imposing these policies, you know, London in sort of a theoretical sense, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the Parliament in London and the King instituting these policies on the people of America that they don't like. And so in a sense, this was also a rebellion against that seat of government, that metropolitan center. And so you've got this angst in a similar way to the angst over a king, an executive power. What is the new seat of government going to be? And you know, should it be a powerful thing, or, you know, should it be a weak thing? And there were certainly politicians and people who thought, you know, it should be irrelevant. Like, we do not want to go back to what we did with London. But, you know, there were other people as part of the contest between cities and between jurisdictions and places who thought, no, I mean, we got a lot of benefits from London. We need to do something like that again, and I want it to be in my backyard. And so that was set up that sort of enduring competition that went on for years about where the city should be and what kind of seat of government, which sort of capital it should be.
And then we ultimately decided to pick somewhat random swampy land along a river.
It was not a swamp, I must point out. I think I will spend my life dispelling the swamp myth, though I am certainly not the first person to try. There have been many historians before me now who have emphasized that this it was not a swampy location at all, that there were a few swampy areas, and there were places that, you know, were under the river, essentially, from what we are now. They were reclaimed from the river. But, you know, Capitol Hill was on a hill. You know, the elevation was actually quite high. Most of the city is built on higher ground than Philadelphia or New York. Yeah, there was some drainage issues in some places of the city, but it really wasn't a swamp. You know, George Washington knew the area well. He knew the problems that confronted founding a federal city in terms of the controversy and competition for it. And he would not have been anxious to place it in a location where construction would have been difficult. There's just many, many things about the swamp story that are illogical. The explanation for the swamp, and I guess I'll digress a little bit here into the 19th century, is that it did become swampy in many places because of a reluctance to build sewers and just sort of 19th century urban habits, which were to dump your garbage and your feces and things like that, just kind of wherever you wanted to put them, and to sort of develop the land without a sense of the environmental impact that we have today. And so by the 1830s and 40s, the swamp story becomes more credible. But to start off with, it really wasn't a swamp. So I feel like I've totally hijacked and digressed into something you really didn't intend to. Yeah, but
diplomats got hazard pay here for a long time, at least until the 1900s, because of some of these practices. But that's okay. We're allowed to digress. So we built the city. We started organizing the government here. We brought it together. One of the things that's interesting to me is, was the city still under construction when Washington's term ended? Because my recollection is he did his final address in New York.
Yeah, I mean, let's keep in mind, when we talk about the city in the 1790s, we're talking about mostly some farmhouses and buildings constructed for the workers who were building the federal buildings to live in. So really, it's just a few federal buildings we're talking about at the end of Washington's term that were all under construction. None of them were really finished. Those who have seen HBO's John Adams, I think it's a fair representation of what John Adams found when he came into the city, which was an incomplete White House, an incomplete one-third of the Capitol building, and some buildings for the executive branch that later burned, that burned soon after they were constructed. So a Treasury and a War building, Department of Treasury, Department of War building, that did not survive a fire.
I want to pick that up because I think in the second half of our program, we're going to get a little beyond Washington and into some of those other early presidents, and then bridging toward President Lincoln, who first showed up in the city in the 1830s and in Congress, and then back later in his career, because we had mentioned some of these unresolved issues, these perennial American issues that we have grappled with and continue to grapple with. And so we'll dive all back into that after a word from our sponsors. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Network.
Care insurance, part of your retirement plan. Long-term care is expensive, and it's not covered by traditional types of insurance plans. With benefits designed specifically for the federal family, the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program offers a smart way to help protect savings and assets and remain independent should you need long-term care services someday. Start planning for the future. Take the next step and visit LTCFEDS.com today. That's LTCFEDS.com.
If you're a federal law enforcement officer, then you know to do your job, you tap inside sources. To have a voice on policy and legislation, you join FLIOA. And when you want federal law enforcement officer news and up-to-date federal court decisions, you read FedAgent.com. If you aren't reading FedAgent.com, subscribe today. It's free. Don't let this source pass you by. I'm John Adler, president of the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, and I approve this message.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Network, 1500 AM. We're having our President's Day discussion, and I'm joined in this studio by three historians, Dr. Gautam Rao from American University, Zach Klitzman from the President Lincoln's College, and Dr. Dana Stefanelli from the Papers of George Washington at the Washington Library in Mount Vernon. We've talked about the founding of the federal city, Washington's presidency in specific, but wanted to, in the second half of our program here, kind of move beyond the President Washington and into some of the early presidents, and then bridging into President Lincoln's tenure. So kind of looking at the first 100 years of the nation as it existed in the United States of America. And there are all these unresolved issues and questions about presidential power, and some of these also spilled into kind of the formation of political parties and some of the dynamics that we saw around other leaders. You know, we talked about whether we should have a central bank or not, and those were some serious disputes between some of our early presidents. And I think that, you know, as I understand it, some of those debates also kind of, because they never got resolved, helped inform kind of the circumstances of the Civil War that came, you know, basically 80 years after the founding of the country. So where do we pick up after we, you know, President Washington leaves? We're starting to build the city here in Washington, D.C. The government is getting its feet underneath of it, but we're still constructing these offices and building the government.
I think actually we have to rewind a little bit to the Washington administration itself, where Washington, part of the genius of his presidency is bringing together within his cabinet, or even having a cabinet, that was his idea to a great extent, but bringing together these incredibly talented folks, but they didn't always see eye to eye. And the Hamilton feud with Thomas Jefferson that occurs within the first term that leads to Jefferson leaving the administration eventually, I think that's really where we can see the beginnings of the development of political parties that you were alluding to. And again, the issues that become really relevant are about centralization of power. And Jefferson takes great issue with Hamilton's very aggressive moves to aggrandize power for this new federal government. And for the next 7 years after he leaves the Washington administration, he is pretty much making this the major issue of his political life, and it leads to his election as president.
Great, thanks, Gotham. And what were those dividing lines? Was it really around the notion of the centralization of power? Who keeps it, holds it? Is it the balance between the president and the Congress? You know, we had talked earlier about the judiciary was being formed from whole cloth. You know, they were part of the checks and balances, but how strong were they early on? Were they a factor in this debate, or was it largely between, the president and Congress?
To me, one of the fascinating parts of this time period is that a great deal of things are just up for grabs. The answers are clear to us now because they've occurred and we look at them as precedent. But at the time, things were very much unknown. And so when Hamilton says that the federal government should be able to create a bank in order to pay off its debts, Jefferson says, well, where does it say that in the Constitution? And this is the recurring struggle over whether or not this federal government is going to have the capacity to flexibly grow to accommodate problems that are occurring, or whether the original text of the Constitution is going to constrain its growth and leave these developmental issues to the states. To me, that's, if you have to boil it down to one major issue, that is the dividing line between what becomes Jefferson's party and the Federalist Party that Washington is the leader of, that is the central issue.
You know, I mean, the constitutional questions were important, and they loomed really, really large. But I mean, there was also a lot of angst about sort of the policy questions involved. So maybe sort of one level down from constitutional questions was also about, you know, what sort of republic was this going to be? Was this going to be, you know, an agricultural sort of commodities producing republic? And would the government be a strong advocate for those parts, those constituencies within the republic? Or was this going to be a more commercial, financial, manufacturing-oriented country, place? And was the government going to be primarily responsive to those issues, to those policy interests? There's also a second part, very closely related part of that question over the divisions, the party differences, which is the America's place in the international or Atlantic world and the competition between Great Britain and France and the wars of the French Revolution. So there's that sort of other dimension to this, is that the wars of the French Revolution are playing out, that's the big theater, right? That's the big deal that's going on. And what Americans are arguing about is a little bit of a sideshow and kind of related to that. And so, yes, there's sort of Anglophiles and Francophiles on one side, the Hamiltonians and the Jeffersonians, and sort of a more monarchical centralized government versus a more diffuse republic. But there's also sort of, whose side you're on, Britain or France, the Francophiles or the Anglophiles, the monarchists or the Republicans, also depends on a lot on where your interests lie. Should the government be promoting Northeastern shipping and finance as it's, with high tariffs to protect those goods, or a navy, a robust armed forces that's going to cost a lot of money to protect and advance those interests at home and abroad, or is it going to be a little bit more hands off, and let America's productivity, agricultural, commercial productivity, speak for itself and cut a path for the new republic in the world, in the Atlantic world, and in the larger world, and a lot of that plays out around the centralized power question versus the diffuse republic question.
Zach, I want to bring you in, because part of an additional dynamic that's going on is the country is expanding while we're thinking about all of these issues. And, the founders are, residents of the 13 original colonies, but we start getting inland. We start, crossing rivers and crossing mountains. And, as President Lincoln, was growing up in Illinois and in the central part of the country, what was the view from someone out there who and into all of this debate? How did that change the dynamic?
Well, the thing about Lincoln is that even though he was born in Kentucky, grew up a little bit in Indiana, then settled in Illinois, and all that was very rural back then, he still envisioned a strong central government that would support what was back then called internal improvements. Today we might think of it as infrastructure. So this is bridges, trains, before trains, steamboats. And really this Whiggish idea, after the Whig Party, which became kind of to some degree, the descendants of the Federalist Party. It's not really a one-to-one, but similar in opposition to the Democrats, the Democratic Party, the sense that the government is there to provide services for the people in terms of kind of building the economy. And, of course, in the Western states, they're going to need this development of railroads, of actual roads, too, as well as the rivers. So Lincoln's always kind of committed to this idea of kind of economic opportunity stimulated by the government. Eventually the Whig Party kind of falls apart over the issue of slavery, which is, of course, the huge, issue here under all these debates. There are kind of, it's kind of the elephant in the room, so to speak, that everyone kind of pushes off to the side. And eventually Lincoln, he always was opposed to slavery morally. It was more the issues of the legality of acting against slavery, which is protected in the Constitution. Kind of obliquely, slavery is not mentioned explicitly in the Constitution per se, but just this idea of Western lands as economic engine and opportunity is going to be free, is going to be slave, and then eventually that becomes a huge issue in the 1850s. Jumping ahead a little.
Well, it sounds like this this path that was taken with fostering broader economic opportunity may have been the path that dealt with the situation that Dana was describing. Where does the government put its money? Who does it serve? If everybody uses a road, everyone uses a canal, because you got to move people, goods, whatever. But then again, these dynamics that were bubbling under the surface, eventually kind of explode back onto the scene. Was this issue of slavery just, they just couldn't figure it out during Washington's time and in the constitutional congresses? There was just no consensus, so they figured we've got enough other problems, and then it bubbles up again.
Slavery was sort of one issue among many, I think, in the early years of the Republic, and it was a big one, as we know from our history of the Constitutional Convention. You know, one of the big compromises, the Three-Fifths Compromises, is about the slavery question, it took a few years for it to become the biggest overriding political issue of the Republic, and I think internal improvements is also it's one of those issues that comes up a lot. Probably after slavery, it is the most frequently revisited issue by Congress. Certainly not as high profile and as we know, not nearly as fractious as the slavery question becomes.
And at some point, the two issues become hard to pick apart when South Carolina tries to secede almost the first time when Andrew Jackson is president. The stated reason is because of tariffs, the so-called tariff of abomination. But historians pretty widely agree that they're really thinking about what's going to happen to slavery if the federal government has the capability to end slavery, possibly. And so by that point forward, 1830s forward, really, you see tariff is still very important. These internal improvements issues are really important, but the national debate between sections of the country is going to be chiefly about what to do about slavery.
To kind of jump ahead just a little bit, when it comes to what caused the actual Civil War in the 1860s, every now and then you'll hear certain people say it was tariffs or economic issues. It wasn't slavery. And to that, to the earlier point, it's all based on slavery. At the end of the day, tariffs, economic issues, states' rights, it all comes back to that slave issue question. And so, starting with the 1830s, if not sooner, this issue of any time economic issues come to, discussion, slavery is always a factor to some degree, even if it's not explicit. It's always there beneath the surface.
One of the early constitutional questions was representation, right? This is the other big compromise from the Constitutional Convention was representation for the states in Congress. And so we know that there's the Great Compromise where each state gets equal representation in the Senate. And at the time, it was thought of much more as a small state, large state kind of question. Later on, I think it transitions to more of a states with aligned policies kind of question. And of course, as we get into the 1830s and 40s, that becomes a slave state versus free state representation in Congress question. They did not know it at the time that they were sort of baking that competition into the cake early on, but it certainly becomes sort of the defining feature of American politics as the century advances.
Great. And I want to pick back up on that theme as we enter our last segment and really look at that period of the 1830s or so into the Civil War and looking at President Lincoln's kind of political career that kind of bridges this broad debate that at some point tears our country apart, and then he helps bring that back together. We're going to enter our last commercial break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Network, 1500 AM.
Make long-term care insurance part of your retirement plan. Long-term care is expensive, and it's not covered by traditional types of insurance plans. With benefits designed specifically for the federal family, the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program offers a smart way to help protect savings and assets and remain independent should you need long-term care services someday. Start planning for the future. Take the next step and visit LTCFEDS.com today. That's LTCFEDS.com.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Network, 1500 AM. We're in the last segment of our program with three historians, Dr. Gautam Rao, Dr. Dana Stefanelli, and Zach Klitzman, talking about the presidents in the first 100 years of our country or so. And as we're entering this last segment, we're bridging past the founders and into the period of time leading up to the Civil War and the presidency of President Lincoln. And Zach, from President Lincoln's College, I wanted to go to you to talk a little bit more about kind of Lincoln's perspective on the founders and kind of what was going on in his political career as we got to the point of time that led to his presidency ultimately in the Civil War.
Sure. So the thing about Lincoln is he was one of the first presidents born in the 19th century, and so he's definitely the generation after the founders. As he's coming into, you know, adulthood, the last of the founders are dying off. James Madison was one of the last signers of the Constitution who died, I believe, in the 1830s. And in 1838, Lincoln gave one of his first public speeches in Springfield, Illinois. It's called the Lyceum Address. And in it, he talked a lot about this legacy that the founders had left for the country. He described the founders as a forest of oaks. And, you know, they bequeathed a legacy of, you know, by hardy, brave, patriotic ancestors of these temples of these real institutions of liberty and democracy and freedom. And he really came back to the Declaration of Independence throughout his career, both early on in that 1830s period, but even through his presidency. He really viewed this document, the Declaration, as this kind of beacon of hope for the nation, kind of an apple of gold was one of the quotes he used, quoting the Bible and describing it. And you know, he really did admire Jefferson. He certainly realized some of the flaws Jefferson had, but he really viewed this document and the Constitution, of course. You know, he always was a lawyer, so it's all about those legal documents. But he really did view them as this kind of through line through the first, you know, 80 plus years of American history. In a speech during the 1858 campaign against Stephen Douglas for the Senate, he described the Declaration as the electric cord that links patriotic hearts. And he actually was talking a little bit about the concept of foreigners coming to America and immigration and how the rights of the Declaration still applied to them as much as it applied to the founding generation. And so he really did view these central documents from the founding generation as kind of the basis of the Union. And so then when the Civil War, you know, breaks out, he really goes back to these documents as, you know, reasons why the Union should stay together, not kind of divide apart. Okay, we'll have a slave version, we'll have a, you know, free version of America. No, we need one solid union together.
Thanks, and I'd be interested, Gautam or Dana, kind of as you've looked at, you know, the role of the presidency over time. How did where Lincoln landed jive with what's just been described? I mean, it seems like a natural progression, and again, maybe we can benefit from, you know, 2020 vision, but. How did that all shake out?
Well, I think the status of the founding documents, Declaration, Constitution, in this time period is a very interesting question because to some extent, up until maybe the Jackson presidency, you still get the sense that the institution is not comfortable in its own skin, whereas by the time we get to Lincoln, there is sort of reverential looking back at this history. There are histories that are going to come out of the time period which are really glorifying where the country comes from and what the role of the founders were. So I think to some extent Lincoln's moment there against Douglas and later on, I mean, he's known for his speech writing obviously, it does indicate a kind of maturity of the nation state and of the presidency itself, which certainly didn't exist just 30 or 40 years previous.
time needed to mature kind of the nationalist instincts that defined what the country felt about itself and its own origin story.
And it's a bit ironic, of course, because it's on the cusp of the Union coming apart at the moment where Lincoln is asserting that kind of maturity. Yeah, I think, you know, Lincoln also, as a strategist, is worth noting here, because he's very careful in his as the Civil War is about to start, he's very careful to not recognize the Confederacy as a nation. So this is not for him a war between nations, but rather at least in legal theory, an enormous police action to get citizens who are out of line back into line. And so that he's never going to give legitimacy to a group that's trying to tear apart the Union.
Absolutely. I mean, he almost exclusively refers to it as like the rebellion or the rebellious states. He never, you know, really defers to the legitimacy of someone like Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy. It really is that sense that, no, this is the Union and we are putting it back together.
Yeah, I mean, not to make it all about Washington, but
it is his birthday after all.
But I mean, you know, there were some lessons perhaps that Lincoln took from Washington and his presidency. You know, when Washington started out as commander in chief during the Revolution, he was very deferential to Congress, and he continued to be throughout the war. But he has also had some doubts along the way about deferring to Congress. And I think that experience of the Revolution, the Confederation years, emphasized for him that perhaps it is not wise to always be deferential to Congress and other institutions, governmental institutions, including the states and their governments. But you know, the most important thing that you can do as a leader is to take the initiative and to take action. And I feel like without having a quote or anything, a Lincoln quote or anything to back it up, that was certainly a lesson that Lincoln took to heart, right? Like when there is a crisis, when there is a war going on, when you don't know where everyone's loyalties lie or where they will be in the near future, then it is incumbent upon you to take swift and decisive action on those things that you can do that with, right? That you can constitutionally, in those areas where you can, where your responsibilities, primary responsibilities lay.
Absolutely, yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, perhaps the best example of that is the Emancipation Proclamation, which Lincoln issued while living at the cottage where I work. And, you know, it wasn't passed by Congress. It wasn't, you know, an official piece of legislation. It was a wartime, you know, presidential proclamation. It only freed slaves in areas that were in rebellion. Again, not the Confederacy, but in rebellion, because theoretically the president has jurisdiction in those areas in times of rebellion. And therefore, you know, he knew that it was only a temporary solution. He knew that there needed to be a constitutional amendment abolishing slavery. And towards the end of his first term, but really in 1865 in January and earlier too, he really pushed for this amendment, which passed Congress in January 1865, as depicted in the movie Lincoln. Unfortunately, he was assassinated before it was ratified later that December, but he knew that he had to take the initiative in 1862. It took him a while to kind of come around, but he realized that summer that this is the way the war was shaping up, and he took that decisive action, you know, perhaps using Washington's example to some degree, maybe not literally on the issue of slavery, but certainly in terms of strong leadership and strategic thinking. And then he knew, again, he's the lawyer. He knows legally if a new president comes aboard, maybe he'll overturn the proclamation. So towards the end, he did push for that constitutional amendment.
It is interesting how we, you know, Lincoln's legacy because of the Civil War, that some of the decisions that were made perhaps in haste about the use of the military to police people, the suspension of habeas corpus. These are viewed as kind of footnotes in the Lincoln story, whereas if you think back to John Adams, who, you know, Alien Sedition Acts, and that's what he's remembered for, right? Chiefly for trampling upon civil liberties. So it's just a funny thing how history works. The victory of Lincoln in the war overshadows any sort of those issues.
And specifically, his assassination really kind of just changes the whole tenure of his presidency, you know, in a way that he almost becomes this kind of like second to Washington, an American saint. And there's all these images from the time of him kind of ascending to heaven with Washington happily greeting him. And if he hadn't been assassinated, who knows what, you know, how we would view that, or how people at the time would have viewed Lincoln. You know, there's this one counterfactual novel that presupposes that Lincoln survives the assassination and then he's impeached, not Andrew Johnson. So that, you know, obviously it's fiction, but kind of an example. We don't know what, you know, his legacy would have been. Maybe he would have been charged on the, you know, habeas corpus suspension, that kind of stuff.
Great. This has been so fascinating. We've got just a few minutes left. Any concluding thoughts or ways to wrap this up briefly from each of you? You know, I think this was a really interesting conversation about, you know, the first 80-100 years of our nation's kind of official history as a nation state. But again, as we mentioned throughout, you know, these issues of the power of the presidency and kind of how we work out issues in our country are ever present. Let's just go down the line real quick. Gotham, any final thoughts?
Well, this is great fun. So thanks for having me. I think it's fascinating to me. Every now and then you open up a newspaper and you see an op-ed about the death of Americans' interest in history. And I'm always puzzled by that, because anyone who goes to an airport and to a bookstore, I mean, there's just dozens of books about exactly the stuff we've been talking about here. And it's quite heartening to me that interest, particularly in some of the issues we've been talking about, that interest endures, really. And I think, you know, the greater the extent to which we can keep these stories and histories, rather, germane to our own experiences today is of great civic importance. So, I think it's a good, very good aspect to President's Day.
Thank you, Gotham. Zach?
Yeah, I would only say that the thing about the presidents that really always strikes me is just reading their words and how they really felt about their legacy or their, you know, their times, their policies. Obviously, they're always kind of like, you know, angling here and there for certain things. But going back to what they literally said, I think is always an important thing, whether it's in books, at historic sites like President Lincoln's Cottage or Mount Vernon, of course, in the Washington Papers. But really going back to that sense of, you know, how they view themselves and their times and really the context there. You know, sometimes modern history, we think we know, like, all these myths and stuff and, you know, specific anecdotes of presidents, but really looking at their own words and how they felt on the issues, I think, is always an important element to keep in mind.
Thank you, Zach.
Yeah, well, I'll try and follow the theme and make a plea for people to educate history education and the importance of it, certainly. You know, I mean, in Washington and Lincoln, you have two people. I guess technically Washington wasn't president at the time, but two people who sort of presided over civil wars in their own countries, or, you know, when Americans were deeply divided over the most critical issues of the day. And so, you know, I read the newspapers, as they say, online usually. You know, this is something that people are justifiably preoccupied with in our own time. And so there are lessons, good and bad, I think, to be found with all of these early presidents, and especially Lincoln and Washington in that area.
Fabulous. Well, for our listeners, I'd like to thank again Dr. Dana Stefanelli from the Papers of George Washington at the Washington Library at Mount Vernon, Zach Klitzman with the President Lincoln's College, American University. Please check them out. Check out their works and the organizations they're working with. There's lots more to learn and to hear. This has been Fed Talk on Federal News Network, brought to you by the Federal Employment Law Firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.